So welcome. We are in for a real treat, as I was sharing today. We are here tonight for the training on understanding border carbon adjustments. We're going to be joined from CCL's board chairman, Professor Ross Astoria, for a training that reviews the basics of border carbon adjustments, how they're viewed constitutionally and in terms of trade legality, as well as the practical aspects of these adjustments and their implementation along with their constraints. And our three main areas of learning tonight, our goals are reviewing the history and context for how really the background behind international trade law is governed, how this fits in with the existing framework. We're going to examine specifically the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act's border carbon adjustment design, what's actually written in the bill text, and how it is interpreted in agencies that will be responsible for interpreting it. And then we'll have a chance to understand the impact of these adjustments for international climate diplomacy, because there's a lot going on if you haven't been paying attention on the international scene. So with us to take us through that tonight is the wonderful Dr. Ross Astoria. Ross is professor and chair of the Department of Politics, Philosophy, and Law at the University of Wisconsin at Parkside. He also happens to serve as the board chair for Citizens Climate Lobby and was responsible for a lot of the legislative texts behind our beloved Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. So if you're looking for an expert on the scene with all of those gifts together, you've got it, the full package tonight in Ross. I'll pass it to you, Ross. Thanks all for sticking with us here. And the floor is yours, Dr. Astoria.
All right, great. Thank you all. Thank you so much for being here, everyone. I see there's 63 people here at the moment. I never thought border carbon adjustments would be quite this popular when I started working on this problem. We're going to go through quickly through the history of trade treaties, which are pertinent to a border carbon adjustment. We're going to look at tariffs and some other aspects of international trade law and resolving disputes that happen during trade. And then we're going to take those high level kind of general legal features of those treaties and apply them to our context of trade in fossil fuels and in carbon intensive goods. Quick slide here is we get tons and tons of questions about international competitiveness and questions about what other countries are doing about mitigation. And the context of those are usually about international competitiveness. So the more we can answer these questions, the better. All right, so part of the governance challenge here is we want to get to a stable climate. We want some simplicity and low cost, fairness and transparency, and that includes in trade. And one thing I want to highlight here, when we look at a border carbon adjustment, the ideal scenario is it's not needed, because in that instance, when we're not using the border carbon adjustment, it means that our trading partners in other countries are meeting their mitigation goals. And then if we can't do that, we want to make sure that we have fairness, a level playing field with respect to international trade. All right, so generally, high level, what is a border carbon adjustment? So a border carbon adjustment is placed on goods imported from or exported to countries without an equivalent carbon price or other mitigation policies. It has two parts. The first is an equivalence fee on imports from countries without similar carbon price. And the second is a rebate of exports from the United States that are going to other countries. That's a general overview. We'll get into some details here in a moment. All right, our major trade treaty that we're going to be working with here in the context of border carbon adjustments is the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade is a part of a suite of trade treaties administered by the World Trade Organization. And together, these form a set of rules of trade between nations. So recently in the public dialogue, mostly from the United States Secretary of State at the moment, you'll see an affirmation of rules-based trade. So this is what they're gesturing at here, this suite of treaties that are meant to kind of make trade flow between countries in a somewhat predictable way where trade is not being used for politics. And again, the GATT here is our main treaty, first ratified in 1947. And what's happened since 1947 is from a small group of European countries, really, who had just finished fighting a very devastating Second World War. Those kind of more and more countries agreed to participate in the GATT through a round of trade negotiations. And then what happened in one of those final rounds of trade negotiations in Marrakesh in 1994, those countries agreed to establish the WTO. The WTO includes the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs as a kind of overarching treaty on trade, but it also includes a suite of other treaties along with a dispute resolution system. In addition to climate and other kind of emergencies of a global proportion going on, we're also at a kind of inflection point in the characteristic of international trade. And so one thing it looks like is also happening at the moment is that the GATT, rather than being an overarching kind of framework for trade, is it looks like a whole bunch of other bilateral treaties are occurring between countries, which is making a more pluralistic system. So in addition to the concerns about climate, that is also happening. All right, let's take a look at some of the specifics of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. These are called disciplines, usually, rather than laws. So we're going to look at tariffs. We're going to look at Article 1, which is about most favored status. We'll look at Article 3 of the GATT, which is about national treatment. And then we'll look at the general exceptions in Article 20. All right, so what is a tariff? All right, so you can think of a tariff as a right to access, and in this case, the right to access American markets. And the way that the GATT is set up is each country produces its own what's called a harmonized tariff schedule. And in that harmonized tariff schedule, the country sets out the tariffs, the duties it's going to charge on imports of different goods. And so what I have here is an example of the U.S. harmonized tariff schedule. This is just the very first page under animals. It's all alphabetical. And so I just want to show here the different columns. So on the left, the two columns there are a heading and some subheading by a numerical identifier of the product, an article description. So you've got live horses, asses, mules, heinies, different types of horses, purebred, breeding animals, divided by gender or sex rather, so on and so forth. And then you can see the unit of quantity. And then what you have here on the right-hand columns is you've got the rate of duties. And those are divided into section one and section two. Under section one, you have general and special. General is the baseline, the benchmark that is charged as a tariff. Special is are those considerations where the tariff has been dropped for one reason or another. So the reason a tariff might be dropped is a free trade agreement or a system of general preferences. All right, so this is where Brett is indicating there are those places where there's no tariff. So there's MX in there, that stands for Mexico, right? So there'll be no tariffs on imports from Mexico because of NAFTA. And then on the right, in number two there, those are the high end of tariffs that we might be able to charge other countries. And I looked this up because I get this question a lot, but what are the conditions under which the United States can change the tariff here? And it turns out the answer is complicated. It depends upon the different statutory authority. So if we're at war, the president has authority to change tariffs. And then if you're North Korea or Cuba, then the president and different agencies also have authority to change these tariffs. So there's some wiggle room in there. Let's take a look at another tariff schedule. Steel is going to be our running example throughout the lesson here, and it's one of the most frequent questions. And I just wanted to show to you the kind of the detail available in the article description here. So one of those sections says non-alloy pig iron containing by weight no more than 0.5% of phosphorus, and so on and so forth. And that's just to show that we can indeed keep track of everything that is imported. Let's take one look at another harmonized tariff schedule here in the next slide, please. If you want to look these up, there's a new search engine for the harmonized tariff schedule. And then some of our good partners in the outdoor ski industry asked about skis. And yes, I do. Indeed, we do keep track of imports of skis. So this is under articles and equipment for general physical exercise, gymnastics, athletics, and other sports. Racket, including table tennis, in case you were wondering, table tennis was a sport, or other games, so on and so forth. We have got all of this stuff kind of tagged and tracked. Let's take a look at the next slide. Okay, so let me pause there before I get to the next article. Take home points here for tariffs. One, we are keeping track of things that are imported. So when it comes to applying a border carbon adjustment, we won't have much trouble identifying those, where they came from or how much. A second thing to be aware of here is a tariff is different than a border carbon adjustment. With a kind of lay audience, you will be okay with describing a border carbon adjustment as a tariff. But if you describe the border carbon adjustment as a tariff to a trade law lawyer, they will lose their mind because they are different things, and it sounds like you will be violating the harmonized tariff schedule. So just be aware of that. All right, GATT Article 1 is called the most favored nation. That's a very odd phrase, but what it means is it's a principle that means trade without discrimination, and it means that any country that is a member of the GATT must treat all countries importing to it in the same way that it treats the most favored nation importing into it. So this means that the United States, for instance, cannot have different tariffs for different countries. If it has a tariff schedule of $1 per ton of steel for imports from Canada, and that is the best rate, then it must charge that same tariff on imports from all other countries. So most favored nation status is kind of the baseline. And if you if you deviate from that, you will be violating the most favored nation status. So let's take a look at Article 3, national treatment. This means that any country, a party to the GATT, must treat imports the same as it treats national products of the same type. So for instance, if the United States has a excise tax on steel of $1 per ton, then it can charge that same excise tax on steel imported from Canada, but it can't charge a higher rate than that. And then the third article that is of concern to us is Article 20, general exceptions. This allows countries to make exceptions to otherwise applicable trade disciplines in a number of instances. And so the ones of most concern to us here are B and G, which are you can, a country can use a trade measure if it is necessary to protect human, animal, or plant life or health, or relating to the conservation of exhaustible natural resources. There are other of them, and one that's been popping up in the news, particularly during the last administration, is there's a national security exception available. So I think the next slide is a summary of those. Let's just point out one here where the Energy Innovation Act echoes the language in the GATT. So the purpose of our border carbon adjustment is to protect animal, plant, human life and health, to conserve exhaustible natural resources and by preventing carbon leakage, and to facilitate the creation of international agreements. So that is just to get any interpreter of this language kind of thinking about the purpose of the border carbon adjustment and aligning it with the purposes of the GATT. So I want to do a summary here. So we have Article 1 and we have Article 3. One way to think about those in combination is those together are trying to make it so that amongst trading partners in the GATT, everyone is kind of treated the same, right? So a country can't discriminate against products between different countries importing into it, and it can't discriminate between its own products and the products of another country, right? So it's supposed to be a level playing field, and then Article 20 is an exception to that. One last thing about the WTO pertinent to our inquiry here is there is a dispute resolution mechanism. And what happens is when one country kind of brings an arbitration, what we would think of as a lawsuit against another, a panel of three individuals makes a determination as to whether or not there's been a violation of the GATT disciplines. If a country is found to be non-compliant, then it has two choices. One, it can bring itself into compliance. And if it doesn't, then the other country who won the suit, who won the arbitration, can levy equivalent countervailing measures. Those equivalent countervailing measures are also supervised by the WTO to try to make sure that they are in fact equivalent, right? So there's a kind of a tit for tat there, but even that process is supposed to be monitored by the WTO. All right, let's bring those general features into a concrete example, and that's our border carbon adjustment. All right, so the Energy Innovation Act does two things. It makes a distinction between imports and exports, and then it makes a distinction between covered fuels and it makes an emission intensive trade exposed goods. So let's take a look at fossil fuels, covered fuels in this language here first. All right, so how do we know how much to levy, how much of the fee on an imported fossil fuel will be? It turns out the good folks at the Argonne National Laboratory have been working on this for some time, as well as California. So we can identify the carbon content, right? How much prospective carbon dioxide emissions will issue from an imported fossil fuel through the use of what is called the greenhouse gases regulated emissions and energy use in the transportation model, or the GREET model. And you can just Google that and download that. It's a spreadsheet, and then you can use it. And I've got an example here of how that turns out. And this this graphic here on the right is actually the GREET model applied to the California situation. California has what's called a low carbon fuel standard. And in order to administrate the low carbon fuel standard, they need to identify the grams of carbon dioxide pollution per megajoule of fossil fuel. And that's what they're doing in this table here. So you can see on the left-hand column is the originating country, Angola, Brazil, Canada. And then the crudes have names. So just like we keep track of imported things in the harmonized tariff schedule, we have some, I think these names are kind of wonderful. I always think of like a wine list here. So the Cold Lake vintage, the High Prairie bitumen vintage, the light sweet. It's a wonderful set of names. And you can see the carbon intensity here. Here it's set out in grams per megajoule, but you can see some of those carbon intensities are as high as 21 grams of carbon pollution per megajoule. And then you can see the total volume imported into California per year. All right, so the point here is the underlying data for these types of tables will allow us to identify the carbon intensity of imported fossil fuels. All right, much more complicated here are carbon intensive goods or emission intensive trade exposed goods. Now, generally in the literature here and in the governance structures, a good, a product is carbon intensive when its emission intensity meets a certain ratio. So emission intensity is the product's value in dollars against its greenhouse gas emissions. right? And then you'll have a cutoff point there in emission intensity. It might be 5%, it might be 10% there. And then you'll have a trade intensity. And this is when a certain portion of the product is traded internationally. So you take a look at all of the product traded and consumed in a country and you figure out what portion of that is traded. And again, there might be different cutoff points there. So around 15%. And then the energy trade exposed goods are those firms that use a lot of energy and are in a kind of a trade competitive environment. An overview of kind of how many different types of industries are in the energy emission intensive trade exposed arena. So the North American Industry Classification System has about 500 industry groups, and less than 10% of them are in this category. And they comprise about 12% of total US manufacturing output, less than 2% of GDP, and they employ about 0.5% of US workers. So important, but not huge and all-encompassing. And then here is a graphic kind of showing, a nice graphic showing those different industries. This is a graphic from a 2009 study looking at the Waxman-Markey bill. And what you have here is on the horizon, you have energy intensity or emission intensity. And then on the vertical, you have trade intensity. And then the dotted line is the cutoff points where we identify something as trade exposed or emission intensive. Everything to the north and the east of the dotted line is a carbon intensive good. The size of the bubble here is kind of the amount of emissions. And you got your usual suspects here, lime manufacturing, ceramics, nitrogen fertilizer, but you also have some non-suspects. You have malt manufacturing, wet corn milling, yarn spinning, and newspaper mills. I guess paper would be in there. But anyway, you can kind of get a sense of how these things play out for identifying in energy intensive trade exposed goods. All right, let's continue with our example of steel here. And steel usually comes up in the context of China. So this slide here is based upon the wonderful work of one of the CCL volunteers / interns, employees, Jess Wilbur, who's would do these slides, except she's camping right now. And one of the take-home points here is with respect to steel and more or less across the board, the U.S. has a strong comparative advantage with respect to carbon intensity. And so how does this work out? There's two general ways to produce steel. One is a basic oxygen furnace, and the other is the electric arc furnace. The average, for the BOF, average carbon emissions per ton of steel is about 2.5, and for the EAF, average emissions is somewhere between two tenths and 0.4 of a ton of carbon dioxide per ton of steel. And so America's carbon advantage with respect to steel produced in China is based upon the proportion of manufacturing that is EAF versus BOF. And you can kind of see that here in the statistic, right? So we just have a lot of EAF manufacturing right now. There's a little tricky thing here. You can see in the next slide, however, the emission, this is a slide of the emissions from metal production in the United States. And you can create these graphs for yourself in about 20 seconds by going to the US inventory and saying, make a graph. And you can see that red block there is emissions greenhouse gas emissions from iron and steel production and metallurgical coke production declining over since 1990 with that prominent dip there during the recession. What you would have to do here is to figure out what proportion of those emission reductions are due to reduced production versus the switching over to EAF. One of the tricks of EAF is it works with recycled steel, but not new steel, right? So reducing emissions requires a kind of radical reuse of materials, in our case, steel. I think I got one more thing on steel here. And then here, just a nice graphic showing the flows of steel in and out of China. So this one on the upper left here is imports, China's imports of iron ore. And you can see some kind of prominent things here. So from Australia and then from Latin America. And then if you look at next net exports, the upper right, you can see that some of those exports do go to North America, but by no means is it a kind of large, it's significant, but not an over preponderant portion of China's exports. All right, so some graphics there to put things in context a little bit, because I think part of the discourse here is that the United States is completely dependent upon manufactured steel from China, and they only ship to other countries. And that's just not the case. There's a whole web of things going on here. So let's look at the next slide, please. All right, how would the border carbon adjustment be administered? So the technical aspects of it, that is identifying the carbon intensity of imported products, would be carried out by the Secretary of Treasury and the EPA. So the Treasury Secretary actually kind of collects it. And then there's all these other agencies that have different types of data, and the Treasury Secretary would rely upon them for that data. At the beginning, I began with the observation that the border, in the ideal situation, border carbon adjustment isn't being used because other countries are meeting their mitigation objectives. And part of the trick to that is to use the border carbon adjustment to engage in climate diplomacy with other countries. So let's take a look at that. And I was watching the chat there at the beginning, and this seemed to be one of the prominent topics. So here, just a reminder of those countries that have some sort of carbon price. All right, so not insignificant. Generally speaking, most people think that these carbon prices have two weaknesses. One is they're not high enough. Two, they have various types of holes in them, right? So you wanna repair, use climate diplomacy to repair both of those infirmities in carbon pricing. Now, let's look at some of the other constraints on using a border carbon adjustment. There's a really interesting case out of the WTO from the 90s called US shrimp turtle. Now, what was happening in that case is the United States was using its Endangered Species Act, and it had classified the sea turtle, various species of sea turtle, as endangered or threatened. It was actually the Department of Commerce decided that, okay, one thing we have to do to protect the endangered species is we are going to say that you cannot import shrimp to the United States unless that shrimp was caught in a net that included a turtle exclusion device, a TED. And countries sued. They brought an arbitration case to the WTO. And the WTO said a couple things. It said, one, countries that are a party to the GATT can in fact use a border measure to achieve an environmental purpose. So that's good, but they have to do two things. One, they have to allow other countries to achieve the environmental purpose using policies of their own choosing. And two, they have to kind of reach out to those other countries and try to form some sort of partnership, treaty, or agreement to do this in collaboration. Okay, and what does this mean for the border carbon adjustment? It means that the United States can put up a border carbon adjustment, all right, it has an environmental purpose, But we've got to do two things. We got to have some way to credit other countries' mitigation efforts and suspend the border carbon adjustment when they're meeting their mitigation efforts. And then we've got to do that in a kind of a diplomatic means, right? So climate diplomacy is good in and of itself, but it's required of the WTO in this case. And I love that picture of a turtle. Okay, and so our border carbon adjustment will encourage trade partners to implement their own prices on carbon. However, the border carbon adjustments are administratively complex, as we've kind of been going through. And so we want to resolve border carbon adjustment questions through agreements, diplomatic agreements, and the Energy Innovation Act allows suspension when importing countries have equivalent mitigation policies, and allows suspension with an international agreement. And here's the language in which that is achieved. All right, so one way to think about climate diplomacy is through carbon clubs. And so two countries might negotiate a bilateral carbon pricing agreement and then expand it to other countries. And I had some recommended reading here for you, and there's a wonderful, I guess it's an opinion slash strategy piece in I think the Foreign Affairs magazine about how the United States could do that and how that could play into other diplomatic considerations. And then we get more and more people into the club. Another thing we might have to do here is the GATT, I think in this case is not overtly hostile to climate mitigation efforts, but it's also not entirely friendly. So I think the WTO, there might be quite a bit of stuff to reform and revise the WTO that can be initiated through the United States here. And then the Paris Agreement is another forum for climate diplomacy. It doesn't call for global carbon pricing, but countries can adopt those on their own initiative. And I think in the next slide, I've got some concrete examples here. All right, yes. So the EU, I saw this question was floating around the chat box. So at the beginning of March, the European Parliament voted to institute a border carbon adjustment measure. And the terminology border carbon adjustment measure is not an accident. It's not a border carbon adjustment, border tax adjustment. So what is happening here is you can do a border carbon adjustment when you have a domestic carbon tax, right? National treatment, you can do a border carbon adjustment when you have a domestic carbon tax, but the EU does not have a carbon tax. It has its pricing is a cap and trade. And so they're calling it a border carbon adjustment. A couple other kind of domestic strategic things the EU's got to figure out here. Their cap and trade system has free allocations in it. These are kind of holes in the coverage of their carbon pricing, and those need to be patched. So it will almost certainly violate the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs if the EU has both a border adjustment mechanism and those holes in their cap and trade system. One thing to note here is the European Parliament seems to be anticipating that they'll have to rely upon Article 20 rather than having it comply with national treatment and the most favored nation status. Another thing here is it's not clear as if an export refund is possible. You can do an export refund for certain sorts of domestic taxes, and that's how that our border carbon adjustment works. But again, the cap and trade is a price on carbon, but it's not a tax. So it's not entirely clear that the EU will be able to have a refund. And that document, it has very much the feel of a text in it, and it lays out a lot of the considerations that I've put out here. All right, so nothing I said here is new. You can find it in the document. All right, so that's the EU scene. All right, let's look at how those kind of things might tie together. So I noted that a border carbon adjustment has to have some sort of suspension provision in it. So one way to think about this is you could have the NAFTA two countries, i.e. Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And then the United States might have a border carbon adjustment on imports from Canada and Mexico. We might get together and say, okay, let's talk about emissions from steel. And we might decide that the thing to do here is to drop the border carbon adjustment for steel between those three countries, but to establish some sort of consortium that is designed to think about the greenhouse gas emissions from steel amongst those three countries, and then to figure out what other measures are needed in order to get to zero steel emissions just amongst those three countries. And then we might figure out amongst ourselves what other outreaches we need to do to other countries to make sure that we're not shuffling emissions to third-party countries. Back to the EU, US and China. So one thing that's happened here is the EU border carbon adjustment measure will also apply to imports from China. And prior to some recent diplomatic friction between those two countries slash trading blocks, they had a bilateral investment treaty set to go into place. And that treaty, it says investment in there, but you have some substantive things on the Paris Agreement and the International Labor Organization standards. So that is on hold there. But that is one way to think about those agreements. And there's a nice piece in the recommended blogs from Adam Tooze on whether or not the United States and the EU and other countries are going, so there's a diplomatic effort to kind of work on mitigation with China and to try to bracket the other frictions between those three countries. And Adam Tooze points out that that's going to be conceptually possible, but rather challenging if you have commitments to human rights, to labor standards, and to democracy. So how to carve off those other things and work on mitigation is challenging. And then one more example here from the Paris Agreement. Article 6 of the Paris Agreement allows for what are called internationally traded mitigation outcomes under the acronym ITMOS. And what these do is they allow countries or private parties to basically purchase mitigation in another country and have that mitigation show up on the mitigation ledger of the other country, right? So Article 6 in the Paris Agreement is still being worked out, but interestingly enough, Peru and Switzerland are at the forefront of pioneering. Switzerland is not part of the EU, by the way, but pioneering an agreement as to how those ITMOs might work out. And so you can kind of see you've got a non-material trade going on between Peru and Switzerland, i.e. a mitigation outcome. And then you've got to have, as part of your agreement, a way to figure out on whose ledger, whose greenhouse gas ledger that mitigation counts. So a whole bunch of different things going on here with respect to climate diplomacy. All right. Take home points. Carbon intensive goods and fossil fuels entering the country are eligible for carbon border adjustment. Properly constructed adjustment is compliant with the most favored nation discipline and the national treatment discipline. And then diplomacy will be required to integrate mitigation regimes between countries and across borders. And I think that's the last slide here. Oh, there's some further reading. Let's do the further reading here, and then we can do some questions. So Cosby here has a nice, and Cosby and I have worked on some stuff too. So he's got a nice piece there outlining some of the more technical stuff there. The Climate Leadership Council has a kind of a white paper on America's carbon advantage you can check out. The Resources for the Future has a quite detailed framework proposal for US greenhouse gas taxes with WTO compliant border adjustments. And then I have a lengthy a lengthy legal analysis of how to design the international trade law compliant border tax adjustment. So the short story of that paper is I wrote that after figuring out how to put together a GATT compliant border carbon adjustment and decided to make the background legal reasoning public so that if we had any legal errors in there, people would be able to point them out to us. Okay.
Thank you all so very much for making it and helping educate yourself and your teams. Feel free to take this information back as you prepare for June. If you have any ongoing questions, I'm more than happy to continue to route those to Dr. Astoria. We do definitely recommend the forums where a lot of this is already being discussed. And that is also going to be in the chat, as well as my email here, just brett@citizensclimate.org, as well as the forums link. But it is such a pleasure to have everyone here. Ross, do you have anything else to say in closing?
No, just thank you all. It was wonderful. I never thought when I started studying border carbon adjustments that I would be on a webinar with 70 people wanting to hear about this. So this is great. One of the things I've been doing because of border carbon adjustments is I've been jumping on some of the international calls with the EU and recently with Japan and India, Canada, a little with Mexico. And it's just a fantastic group of people to work with here, both in the United States and across the globe. So it's really, really great. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate your work.
And with that, I will allow everyone to unmute yourself and have a wonderful, safe night. We'll see you on CCL Community and continue to do the amazing work organizing and doing, everyone. Stay safe.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Ross. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Ross. Bye, everybody.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram @CitizensClimate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.